No spacing out. I'm watching you. I've got the best seat in the house to watch you. As I mentioned right from the very beginning, mercy has been kind of the theme of my summer. It's been a time for me to take this very idea, this one word, and not only delve into it in the scriptures and draw more and more from the scriptures, but actually to practice it. And I've looked for and created classrooms for myself, living classrooms for me to say, okay, if this is what it says, let's see what it looks like. If this is what God expects from me, let me try and somehow live this out so I have firsthand experience of feeling this, of experiencing this, of actually doing what I am finding. And part of what that has meant for me is that I am more aware of the fact that every moment of every day I am in need of God's mercy. And every moment of every day I am surrounded by a broken, fallen, messed up world in need of God's mercy. And that God expects of me, as one who has been redeemed, to live out the mercy that I have experienced from Him. Now that's kind of my summary takeaway of what has happened in me in the course of the summer. And my hope and prayer is that that is something that chases you as well. But there's dimensions to this, and we've only had a few weeks to kind of tease this out a bit. And part of what we've talked about is the idea of showing mercy to those out there, somehow, somewhere disconnected from us, people who have experienced the pain and suffering of life, the oppressed people, all that, and to express mercy there. But this morning I'd like to bring it a little closer to home. Because mercy takes on a different nature to it when it touches us, when it's personal. When somehow you are the oppressed. You are the one experiencing the pain. And that God calls upon us to express mercy in the form of forgiveness. We all have something that probably is now coming to mind, and I hope so. Do not somehow blow that out of your head. There are going to be people that come to your mind right now and circumstances that come to your mind right now of people that somehow stand in that place where you are thinking through how in the world do I forgive? For us, there's an ongoing thing right now. My daughter is going through a divorce. It's right at the very tail end of all that mess that goes with that. But we find ourselves, I'm speaking of my wife and I, Ruthie and I, continuously having to address this idea of forgiveness. How do we show mercy to a man who is causing pain to my wife or to my daughter, to our grandchildren, to us? How do you do that? Continuously. I mean, it's not like a one-time deal, but I mean, it's like and you, over and over and over and over again. Do you know what I'm talking about? Just kind of give me a little nod if you do. Okay, we should all be kind of nodding about now. Okay, there it is. So with that, keep that kind of thought there. Now let's bring back a little bit of what we talked about for the last 3 weeks. And that is the idea that mercy itself, my crafting of some kind of a definition to work with, something that's simple enough that I can get it, is that mercy is compassion expressed in acts of kindness. And that's kind of the working definition I find emerging from the scriptures. It's compassion expressed in acts of kindness. And we've talked about the idea, the first week, the idea that God expects mercy from us. I mean, He looks for it. As those of us who have experienced redemption, that have been redeemed, He looks for that in us as one of the evidences that we have indeed been redeemed. Then we talked about, the second week, The idea that mercy takes on form, and one of the things that it does, it makes us aware of the suffering of those around us and changes how we respond to them. If mercy genuinely plays a factor in things, if compassion emerges from us, it changes how we see people and how we respond to them. And then last week we talked about the idea that, you know, how do you become a merciful person? And kind of the key piece in that is that we become a merciful person by first of all becoming a broken person. We come back again and again to the place of realizing that we stand in the place of needing mercy ourselves. And we pray that prayer that has gone down through the ages and all the way up to the present. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And with that, I mean, we kind of move ourselves to this place today and put it in the form of perhaps one of the most difficult things that we're ever asked to do, and that is to forgive. And I'd like to have us go to a very specific place this morning to see how mercy plays into that. And that's in Matthew chapter 18. Kind of make your way there, get yourself all synced up here, and it's going to be in Matthew 18, starting in verse 21. And while you're doing that, let's think just a little bit more about this whole idea of forgiveness, that it is indeed one of the most difficult things that we will ever do in life. And it's one of those factors of life that comes back to us over and over again. It's not like, okay, I can forgive once or I did my big thing, but for many of us, perhaps all of us, it's like a daily feature. That somehow, in some way, or maybe many ways, we have to forgive. Includes forgiving that which is real, and sometimes that which is simply perceived. It includes all those ways in which we've been harmed or offended or betrayed. And it comes from those who are friends and family, perhaps a spouse. It even comes from those who are part of the body of Christ. And we're called to forgive. And as perhaps you have heard and studied and thought about before, that, you know, unless you somehow address this issue of forgiveness, it has devastating effects on us. And we could spend a lot of time with that. I'm not going to do that this morning. But just to kind of bring back in mind the idea that the failure to forgive has devastating effects on us personally. But here's the thing. It also has an effect on everyone else around us. It has an effect on the one who is the offender, the one who is in need of forgiveness. Because when we don't forgive, we condemn people to their past. We basically say, there is no hope from you. I am going to lock you in that past, and I'm going to see you that way for the rest of your life. There is no chance of redemption. There is no chance of change. I'm going to lock you there. It has devastating effects on those around us as well as on us. I've read a lot of books on forgiveness. Perhaps you have as well. I've read books, I've read articles, I've heard people speak on it. And much of that, very good stuff. I mean, I could recommend a lot of it to you. But as I've read through that, and I kind of rehearsed it again over the past couple of weeks here, and that I find that most of what is presented from Christian authors, from even from pastors, is that the biggest reason or motivation for forgiveness is that we will gain from it, that we will benefit from it, and that somehow, you know, we need to forgive, and the only one you're hurting is yourself, and so you need to forgive, and you will come out beneficial on it. I agree, that's absolutely true, but if that's the only motivation you have, if the only reason for forgiveness is so that you will feel better, then you have nothing more than those apart from Christ. Anybody can do that. That's good advice for anybody that walks the face of the earth. You should forgive because you're only hurting yourself. You need to be all that kind of stuff. What I want us to look at this morning is a motivation for forgiveness that is only available to you as one who has been redeemed. It's a motivation that is only available to those who have found new life in Jesus. Only to you. No one else can use this. Pretty good deal, huh? Just for you. And so it's with that that we look into Matthew 18. Now often, particularly with my students in seminary classes, Matthew 18, kind of it's almost like in their minds there's only one section in Matthew 18. Okay. It's like, how do you deal with problem people? You know, and so they go and say, if your brother has offended you, you go to him. Boom. And they want to jump past that one because they want to go to the next one. Let's bring others in on this thing and we're going to smoke this guy. And that's kind of my gracious people. But I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's the place they typically go. I want to go past that. Because as Peter heard Jesus' teaching, he asked the question that probably all of us want to ask. It's like when Jesus asked this question, I wonder if all the other disciples go, yeah, that's a good question. Here's his question. We're in Matthew 18. We're in verse 21. It says, then Peter came and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Good question, huh? Now, notice what he's saying. He's not talking about someone out there. He's not talking about the Roman occupiers who had committed atrocities. That's not even in this frame of reference. He's not talking about some obscure person who's a villain or a criminal or something. He's talking about, you know, someone who's around us all the time. A brother. I wonder if Peter had somebody in mind. Or if he had multiple people in mind. I mean, if he's kind of going through and said, wait, Jesus, no. What about, and then kind of teased out a couple of names. Did you know these guys, you know? Obviously, when he uses the terminology here of a brother here, it's somewhat, in fact, even the way he's asking the question, something's happening multiple times. How often shall someone sin against me? Now, when he uses that word, let's kind of get a little bit more into what he's talking about here. When he talks about this idea of how often shall my brother sin against me, he's using a word here for sin that's kind of your big bucket word. It covers everything. It's all the ways that our brokenness and fallenness, all the ways that our sinful nature shows up. It's everything. It can be big things. It can be little things. It's just everything. How often shall my brother sin against me? When I think of this broken fallenness and all the ways kind of just showing up in life, I think of one of my primary classrooms that has become part of my life right now, and that's my brother. I mentioned my brother. If you haven't been around, you know, I'm not going to go back there and do this, but for those who have been around, it's kind of your inside story now. Okay. I was with him again this week, and it's almost impossible to think of a way that our fallenness and brokenness doesn't show up in this man. In his thoughts, in his health, in his perception of life, and everything. It's just one giant broken mess. I was with him yesterday, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, this little sub-conversation that you hope doesn't show, you know, you don't actually say it, you know, but I'm thinking, man, you are so messed up. And here I am with my primary desire, how do I show mercy in the midst of this? That's the kind of word he's talking about. It's all the ways it shows up. As I was looking at this, even the question here, I was thinking this past week of the idea, and I think this is true of all of us, that we tend to be far more aware of sins against us than sins that we commit to others. Is that a fair statement? I mean, I'm very much, if you look at me the wrong way, I'll see it. And I'll start attaching motives to it, And I'll wonder, what did that person mean by that? You know? What did, when you just did that, I'll bet you, and I'll put a whole story to it, you know, by the time I'm done. And you may, it may have been nothing to you, but I'm very much aware, just, we all are. And not only that, but as it accumulates, particularly I think in the time that we live, we begin to see ourselves as victims. And we develop a whole victim. Most people I talk to are victims. Life has happened to them. We don't talk about how we have happened to life. And what we do to those around us. But we're aware of this. And Peter was very much aware of this. How many times shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Now that's another key word. That's a big word in this thing. That word forgive. And the Bible has more than one word for this. So it's kind of, it's an interesting one to kind of put into the deal here. Because it's a word that has to do with the idea of letting something go. Of sending it away. Of abandoning it. For those words to work, let me say, letting something go as opposed to holding on tight to it. Sending something away as opposed to drawing it as close as I can. Abandoning something as opposed to nurturing it. It's a word that was used to describe setting a prisoner free. It was a word that was used to describe canceling a debt. And that's where the story kicks. Because when Jesus asked, or when Peter asked this question, it's loaded. How many times shall I forgive somebody? Now, there was a formula at the time. The rabbinic school had actually come up with, I mean, this wasn't the first time this question had been asked. And so in the rabbinic school of Jesus' time, there was an answer. You know how many times you had to forgive somebody? Three. I like that number. In other words, if somebody offends me, like, you know, if we're going along and it's a three strike rule. So if you offend me once, okay, I forgive you. Twice, I forgive you. Three times, you are toast. Because now I can start seeking revenge. So that was the deal. So when Peter asked the question, he thinks he's being magnanimous. How many times shall I forgive somebody? Seven? You know? And I wonder, and you know, kind of in Peter's craziness, I wonder if he's thinking Jesus is going to go, oh, blessings on you. Instead, he gets a typical Jesus answer, doesn't he? I mean, it says that, verse 22, it says, and Jesus, it says, he responded to him and says, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. And Peter's probably going, math. 70, carry the one. I mean, all this. But what Jesus is saying here is that you've got it, your thinking is completely off. It's not a matter of how many times. You're missing the point again, Peter. Just like us. And so Jesus says, okay, it's kind of like he says, okay, sit down. Let me tell you a story. And so we're back into one of Jesus' parables. And you need to keep in mind whenever we read through a parable, when you come across some of the scriptures, that the parables aren't intended to be comprehensive. They're intended to express one main idea. One idea. And to do it in such a way that it goes pow and you can't miss it. So here's what Jesus does. Right? In response to Peter's question, Jesus flips it around on him, does it? Okay? Tells him a story. Here we go. It says, verse 23. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. Okay, so here we start out. It's kind of like this. This isn't it, but it's kind of like this. And he introduces main characters. You've got the king, who is going to be representative of God the Father, and you've got the slaves. That's us. Okay. You may not like that terminology. Oh, well, it's us. And the king desired to settle accounts. Verse 24, and when he had begun to settle them, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. Here's a guy who is so deep in debt that you can't imagine it. Jesus uses extreme terms here. Now, I've read all sorts of stuff, and there are those who try and actually calculate what this number is, but that misses the point again. Jesus wasn't trying to say, here's the exact number. Instead, when Jesus uses the number 10,000, in a Jewish mind, that's the biggest number there is. Okay, so it's like my grandkids, do this all the time, where they're trying to come up with the biggest number, and they might start out with, 1,000, and then the next one wants to, one-up them, and so they'll say 1,000,000, and then, the next one wants to up him, so it's a bazillion, which isn't a number, but a bazillion, and then you've got the trump card, infinity. So that's kind of the idea. Jesus is saying, look, here's the biggest number you guys can think of. 10,000. And then talents. That was the largest, largest denomination of money that the Romans had. A talent was the largest coin they had. There wasn't anything bigger than talents. And so what he's saying is here is a debt that is so massive that you can't even calculate it. But as I read this, I'm thinking, this guy must have been living pretty good, right? I mean, if you've got that kind of debt, man, what kind of cars are you driving? What homes, trips, clothes? I mean, this guy has been doing good, Self-indulgent life. But the king's going to settle accounts. So he comes and... verse 25 says, but since he, the slave, did not have the means to repay, his Lord commanded him to be sold along with his wife and children and all that he had and repayment made. Could not repay the debt. It was impossible. So he will lose everything. Everything. So the slave fell on the ground and prostrated himself before him, saying, have patience with me, and I will repay everything. And the lord of that slave, the king, felt compassion. Remember where that word shows up? Have you been tracking with me for the last 3 weeks? Mercy. The king had compassion and released him and forgave him the debt. Now, here's a picture of us. In fact, we reenacted the picture again this morning, didn't we, Sandra? Okay, right up here. That you and I have experienced this in our life. If we are ones who have come to Jesus and found redemption, this picture that Jesus is creating here is us. We have come to Jesus, and we have settled accounts. Not because of us paying the debt, but because of mercy. God has exercised his prerogative as a king to show mercy to us. That's an interesting thing that I've gone through the scriptures on. But God, God is never obligated to show mercy. Never. He's obligated to be just and holy and all these other things. But mercy is a prerogative. God says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. And if we are those among those who have been redeemed, God has had compassion on us and forgiven us of a debt that is impossible to repay, a debt that is much larger than we can imagine or ever will imagine until we step into his presence. So that's scene one. And it's cool. We can just end it right there when you go, yes, right? Story goes on. It says, but that slave went out, verse 28. But that slave went out and found his fellow, one of his fellow slaves, who owed him 100 denarii. Now, again, the point isn't that here's this huge debt and here's this little tiny debt, as far as trying to figure out the numbers in it. I mean, there is a comparison, but it's not like, okay, 100 denarii, how much is that? It's not a small debt. It's substantial. It would be like almost a half a year's wages during the time for a slave. So it's a big-time deal. But he goes out and he finds this fellow slave, owes him a debt, and does what we would love to do to some people. He found this man, and he seized him and began to choke him. It's like he gets a hold of this guy and just grabs a hold of him. He's got him under his power. That's literally what the word means. He grabs a hold of him. He's got power over this person and throttles him. You know, he's got him by the neck, and he's, you're going to pay me back. You know, this kind of, wouldn't you love to do that to some people? There's some, I mean, let's just be honest. There's some people in your life, there's some people in my life. There are times I would love to just get them around the neck and throttle them. Right? Just being honest. He went out and he got him and says, pay me back what you owe me. You owe me. And that's really at the heart of, well, when we're dealing with forgiveness, that's the big deal. I am going to make you pay. And his fellow slave fell to the ground and began to plead with him, saying, have patience with me and I will repay you. So there's an element of grace that's happening here. There's an opportunity for things to be somehow restored. Because see, this individual, the slave who has just been forgiven, has the same prerogative to exercise mercy. It's his choice. But in verse 30 it says, but he was unwilling. Key word. He chose, I will not do this. He was unwilling, and he went and threw him into prison that he should pay back what he owed. Now, if you think about that, there is no logic in that, right? If he owes you money and you throw him in prison, there is not any chance of him repaying the debt. I mean, it is over, right? I mean, there's no sense to this thing. But that's what we often do. If by failure to forgive, to show mercy, we commit people to their past, we commit them to a debt that cannot be repaid because we will not allow it. So, verse 31. So when his fellow slaves saw what had happened, okay, when his fellow slaves, they saw what had happened. They were deeply grieved. And they came and reported to their Lord all that had happened. Ooh, this is bad. Then summoning him, his Lord, the king, said to him, you wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Now here's the key. I want you to get verse 33, underline this, circle a couple words in it. It said, should you not have also have had mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you? See where we're going with this? I showed you mercy. And I'm expecting that that plays forward on this. Because of the mercy that you have experienced, that you would play that into someone else. And said, and his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers. Now notice it's a different deal now. On the first scene one, he was going to sell him off with everything he had. Now we're in scene three. And he says, no, he hands him over to the torturers. That he is going to experience the torture of an unforgiving spirit. He's going to experience that. Now, here's kind of the deal on this. When the king speaks to this unforgiving slave, he doesn't say, you know, you should forgive this debt because you're going to feel better about it. You know, it's going to benefit, you know, it's going to be beneficial to you. If you forgive, mercy is good for the soul. He doesn't do that. Instead, he equates the mercy that was shown to him with the mercy that he is to express. So if you're going to write anything down this morning, write this next thing down. You will never express more mercy than you have received. You get that? You will never express more mercy to someone else than you have already received from Jesus. Now, in your thoughts, you're saying, oh, but, but you don't know. I know I don't. Doesn't matter. No matter how grievous the offense, it doesn't amount to more than 100 denarii. But you have been forgiven an astronomical debt. Now, we can even play it a little bit more into this thing. You will never forgive more than you have been forgiven. Regardless of what it is. You will never forgive more than you've been forgiven. We, and only us who have experienced God's forgiveness, have this option as a motivation. Let me drop a story in here. So I'm trying to drop a story on top of a story. Remember Zacchaeus? Remember the short guy? Tree, all that stuff? This is a story about him. It's not true. So don't go look in the scriptures to find it. But it could be. This happens years after Zacchaeus has been called down from the tree and he's been forgiven. He's found mercy in Jesus and all this. And years later, he's living and he's poor at this point because he's given everything away. But he's a much happier man. And one night his wife is awakened by rustling and he leaves the house. She hears him leave. And he doesn't return until shortly before the sun's coming up. Unusual. She hasn't seen it. A few days later, it happens again, and this time she's getting a little more concerned. What's going on? Is Zacchaeus doing something that he shouldn't be doing? And so when a few days later it happens again that he gets up quietly at night, dresses, and leaves the house, she decides she'll follow him. And so she quickly gets dressed and she follows him and stays just far enough behind that she can see where he's going, but not let him see her. And through the streets of Jericho, they move and finally out onto one of the avenues, and she follows him down. There's nobody around. And finally, as they come to this one wider space there, she looks, and there he is, seated under a tree. Large tree, sycamore tree. She comes up quietly, sits beside him. And Zacchaeus says, I have to come back here. I have to come back here again and again and again and relive the day that Jesus called my name. The day that he offered to me something that I never thought I could get. That he released me from a debt that was beyond possibility. that he showed mercy to me. And that's the key for us. It's going back again and again and again and having the story replay in our mind that we have received mercy beyond our wildest imagination. And that we will never show anyone else more mercy than we have received. We will never give more forgiveness than we have been given. Never. How does this play out into us? One last thing on here. And with that, I would take us to Colossians. Colossians chapter 3. As it speaks to us as a body of believers. Colossians 3, starting in verse 12, it says, "So, as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion." Very first thing he says, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience. He's just described mercy to us. Bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so should you. Of all the places on the face of the earth, the one place that should be saturated with mercy is here. Among those who have themselves experienced mercy. Mercy beyond our wildest dreams. It should be a place where we are not locked into our past, but are set free. Where we find expressions in the form of words and actions that allow us to move past that, to realize in realistic terms, tangible terms, that we have indeed been forgiven. A place in which we lavish upon each other mercy. Let's pray together.